Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Jay Allison of Transom.org, a showcase and workshop for new public radio. The subject of adoption raises fundamental questions about human nature and identity, and there are a million stories in the answers. Transom's editors collected first-person accounts of adoption for Inside the Adoption Circle, a Transom radio special produced by Vicki Merrick and Samantha Brown. This is Samantha.
Welcome to Inside the Adoption Circle. We've got stories about living with questions and searching for answers. Voices of adoptees, adoptive families, and birth families, where it all begins. We'll start with Elaine, who chose adoption for a birth child in the 1970s.
I was going to college, and I was working at a local fast food restaurant. And I met a guy. He was quite a bit older than me, and we ended up, you know, having a bit of a romance. And I really fell in love with him, and I ended up getting pregnant. When I found out that I was pregnant, I was in denial, and I just hoped that maybe, you know, that he would decide, oh, she's pregnant, I do love her after all, let's get married and raise this baby. Well, that didn't happen. He really wanted me to go to an adoption agency and just be done with it. I am not one of those birth mothers that can say, I thought about you every day, because I couldn't. I couldn't think about him every day. He was very much with me, but I couldn't think of him. It was too horrible that I did that. I remember thinking, okay, Elaine, you're adopted, and this was before I searched for my mother, my birth mother. I remember thinking, you're like in this adoption circle. And at that time, that was like my family was the adoption circle, this group of people that are born to some people, but moved to another family for some reason. And it's just like this underground circle. And I remember thinking, maybe this is your sacrifice, is giving back to that adoption underground circle. And it was kind of a bizarre way that I was able to justify it or to forgive myself in some way for it. I remember the treatment that I got from the doctor. He was very cold, and his whole staff was very cold, and I know that they treated me differently than they treated other women that were having, you know, babies that they were keeping. And in fairness, I don't think that they meant to isolate me, but I don't feel that they knew how to treat me. They just didn't know what to do with me, what to say to me. So consequently, their reaction was just no reaction, just coldness. So after I had my son, I was put in a part of the ward where there weren't any other people. I was just isolated in a room. I remember the social worker coming to me and saying, just sign here. And I remember saying, no, I'm not going to do it. Go away. And I remember her coming back. I don't remember if it was a couple hours or the next day. And I just absolutely refused to sign anything because I was still holding out. I ended up not signing the papers. But I remember going home from the hospital with my son and just really trying to keep him. But the thing was, I was 19, 20 at the time. And so I, you know, when I was pregnant, I ended up moving back with my parents. And they really, really, really wanted me to keep my baby, really wanted me to keep my baby. And their feeling was I could go off to school. They would pay for me to go off to school and stay out of town, out of state, anywhere I wanted. They would pay for it, and they would raise the baby as their own. And I would just kind of be out of the picture. But I just remember feeling that I didn't have that great of a relationship with them, of bonding growing up. And I just felt that he would do better just in a different family, with a mother and father who couldn't have children, that didn't have any children, that would take him. And I just felt if I was not going to raise him myself, that this was the best thing to do. So what happened was, after I saw that he was good, he had a good heart, he was strong, I remember having to actually sneak out of the house with him because I was still living with my parents. And then I ended up taking him to the adoption agency and signing the papers. And I completely betrayed. I completely betrayed my parents. I had to come home and tell them what I did. And my father was calling senators, attorneys, everything to try and get it reversed. I felt so bad for him. But it wasn't going to be reversed.
Elaine made contact with her son when he was 25 years old, and they remain in touch. He now has a family of his own. Chris is also a birth mother who decided on adoption for her son in the early 1990s.
When I was pregnant, I was finishing up my last semester of high school. Went to my prom pregnant. I went to graduation pregnant with a big belly. I think I felt really good being pregnant because then the baby was with me. So I think I was, as much as I was nervous about the birth, I was also anxious because I knew I was going to have to go through this act of giving the baby up. We went to the hospital and I was hooked up to morphine pretty early on. I think that they were really worried about my emotional state with labor and the birth, and I was given an epidural really early, and they augmented the labor. They gave me Pitocin. So they took the baby away, and I remember that night just really struggling. But the next day, we had a little ceremony in the room, and the adoptive parents were there, and, you know, we said a prayer. And I handed them over to them. I handed them their baby, and I gave them lots of loves and kisses, and I wished them well, and I wished the couple well, but I could tell that they were so happy. And I went home from the hospital, and my milk came in, and it was horrible. I was so full, and I was in so much pain, and I remember just sitting there, the milk flowing out of my breast, and I had to bind it. I would wrap an ACE bandage around my breast, and I was trying not to stimulate it. I was trying to suppress the lactation, and it's so weird, even now, that when I sit here and cry about it, it's not a tangible feeling of, oh, that was painful, or it just doesn't feel right. Like, there's just something about it that doesn't feel right. It goes so deep, and it's so past a primal instinct. Even though I knew I was doing the right thing, it's what happened. And it's been really hard to just say, this is a decision I made and I have to be okay with it. It definitely has affected me in many ways. And I never feel like I'm doing enough. And I never feel like I'm doing enough for other people. And I never feel like I'm giving back enough. And I think I've always felt the sense of, if I was going to give him up for adoption so that I could have my life and not be burdened by a baby, or, you know, if I could go away to school and get a degree and go on to get advanced degrees, then I should do it. I should do it all. And I should do it really well. And I should do everything really, really well.
A couple of years ago, Alan, along with his partner at the time, chose adoption for their child.
I feel like a father, even though he is not in my life on a day-to-day basis. I know I'm a father, and even though my child is not with me every day, something changed in me. And when it comes up, you know, if I'm with people and it comes up and someone says something about being a parent, I don't hesitate at all to chime in and say, you know, yeah, I have a son too. And often people will kind of look at me stunned, and I tell them the whole story of this adoption. I met this woman that I ended up living with, and at one point we got pregnant, and it wasn't planned, but we really wanted to give this new being as much of a good chance, the best life that we could. And for that reason, we decided to go with an adoption. And my girlfriend at the time, we just couldn't conceive of having an offspring out there in the world that we were hiding ourselves from. And so with that in mind, we started to pursue some open adoption options. At the end of March, our son was born. We kind of wanted to be able to have him for a number of weeks, just right there at first, because there's really nothing better for a newborn than mother's milk. So we used that time to meet a few of these families and let them meet him. And it was very interesting because sometimes he just had a very negative reaction, and sometimes he had a very positive reaction to the family. But eventually, we went with a family, and when our son met that family, he was very calm the whole time, and actually just kind of seemed like he liked them. It was very interesting to watch. I can call them up and say, I'm coming through. I'm going to be in your area. Do you mind if I stop by? And they're very welcoming of that. And, you know, I can see him. My mother has actually become very close friends with the adoptive family. And he's going to grow up knowing that he has, if he ever needs, you know, an entire other network, an entire other family with grandparents and great-grandparents that he can rely on and come to and learn from at any time. I kind of have to look at myself as, in his life, basically being kind of the role of an uncle, so to say. I thought at first I would be spending a lot of time there, but as time has gone on, although I love to go and see him, I don't end up spending a lot of time there right now because I really have found it more difficult than I anticipated to be around him. Not because I feel particularly sad in any way or regretful. I don't at all. But for me, I feel a little awkward because it's like, oh, hey, thanks for raising my kid, you know. it's closest to not wanting to, and I know it's very strange. It's closest to not wanting to intrude on someone else's life. For as much as all interested parties want an open adoption. There, part of me just can't help but see that environment and think, well, this is, you know, this is his life now. When his mother and I took him to his new family, we had, like I said, we had met them before. We had spent a good deal of time with them, seeing basically if this was a couple of people that we could be friends with. So, yeah, at one point we had let them take him for the day before, and then we just, they just kind of, we gave him to him just like they were taking him for the day, and that was that. And I didn't go to see him right away. I wanted a good several weeks to go by with just this new baby and his new family, just so they got to, so you know, they got used to each other, and my presence, which he already knew, wasn't interfering with that. And then it was interesting. When I first did see him, he, in his little tiny baby way, seemed happy to see me. I think. Maybe I'm imagining that.
This is Hearing Voices, and you are inside the Adoption Circle, hosted by Transom.org producer Samantha Brown.
Aileen and Carrie are sisters in their early 40s. 20 years ago, they were told they have an older brother who had been placed for adoption.
It's a story that you hear about, you know, would be in a movie or something, you know, because it's like they were 16, 17 when they met, and they had this baby, and the baby was adopted by someone, but they still stayed together, and then they had me, and I always felt like I wanted to have an older brother, so when I finally found out when I was, you know, 21 or something, it was like, oh, I have to meet this person.
They were able to keep this secret from us for many, many years, and then we were just hanging out, me and my dad, and he was drunk and told me. I don't think he meant to. He just very casually said, you have an older brother, you know. And I can picture us in the room, but I don't remember what happened after that. I just remember asking a couple questions and then being really sad and crying for a couple days and not talking to my mom about it. And then I finally, she asked me, she said, what's wrong with you? Something's wrong with you. And I told her, I knew, and I said, why didn't you tell me? And she said, because why should you feel sad every day like me? That's what she said.
What if he looks like Dad, you know? Or what if he has Dad's problems and he's, like, struggling because he doesn't understand? Or his family doesn't understand because they don't have that history or something, you know?
I just have this image of this fantasy brother that's happy and looks just like Dad. That's fun to have. And the image or the phantom is more reassuring than what it might be like.
If you're genetically related to someone, you just automatically feel this bond to them. Like, what is that? Is it, you know, is there something inside your blood that makes you be like magnets to each other? I don't know, because there's something that really makes me want to get to know him. And if I see someone on the street that kind of looks like my dad, I'll think that could be him.
I don't feel like he'd be mad at us because we're the siblings. I feel like he's either going to be angry or indifferent. And I believe his family is who adopted and raised him. You know, that's how it is. But you can't help but feel that he's your family too. And so that's why I'm just so curious. Why haven't I found him? It would be like completion is how I can think of it.
When people say, do you have brothers and sisters? I'll say, yes, I have two. I have a sister and brother. But then I think, depending on the person, I'll say, actually, I do have another brother. So yeah, I guess in a way I do kind of count him as part of my family, even though I don't even know what he looks like. Because he is, I guess, you know, he's my older brother.
Here's Kevin. He was adopted in the 1970s.
I couldn't imagine like having a better life, you know, and having the opportunities that I have. Just being adopted, you know, other people, of course, are the ones that let you know that it's strange, you know, because it wasn't for us. Everyone always has questions, you know, what does that feel like? And it's like, it's that's my mom and dad, you know. I put myself in their shoes and, like, you know, they went, they got me, and they took me home, and then they took care of me. And I'm not, you know, I'm not of their blood, yet they love me so much that, you know, how can I not love them back in the same way? I was adopted in this town. And one thing that's a little strange is there was a guy in town that I thought kind of like looked like me. It turns out he was adopted also. And I'm kind of friends with him, but I've never really, we don't talk about that, you know. I don't want to bring that up to him, you know. We have the same teeth. And we also have the same skin color and like the same hair, and it's just a little too close for comfort. And that's kind of another aspect, is nobody looks like me in my family. You know, nobody in this world looks like me except for that guy I was telling you about. I don't even know what I am, but, you know, in this town, there's a large Hispanic population, and I'm pretty sure I was probably Hispanic. But, you know, would I have grown up, would I, you know, have fallen into the traps that, you know, some Hispanic kids do? How many brothers and sisters would I have? Where would we have lived? You know, what would my personality be like? Would it be different? And I've never found my biological parents either. I've thought of it, but I'm going to be 38 next month, and I still haven't really, inside of me, just said, I really need to find out. I've never had a reason, really, I think, because I do. My parents are fantastic, you know, and they always have been, and there's nothing empty, you know. There's nothing that's like, oh, I need this in my life. I'm sure my parents wouldn't have a problem with that, but maybe that's what's stopping me. I don't know, because I feel like maybe, you know, if I did, it would hurt their feelings somehow or something. But I don't know, that's probably just me, you know. Sometimes you'll see other people around, and you're like, well, what if, you know, that might be my mom or something, you know. And I still do that to this day, you know. I'll just be at a grocery store looking around and just wondering, you know, could that be, you know. And maybe I've brushed into her once or twice, or, I mean, this is a small town still. I see people I know every single day, and chances are, yeah, I've probably been in the same building as her at one point or another. It's crazy.
We'll be back in a minute with Inside the Adoption Circle from Hearing Voices.
From NPR, this is hearingvoices.com.
Welcome back to the Hearing Voices presentation of Inside the Adoption Circle, a Transom Radio special produced by Vicki Merrick and Samantha Brown.
I was adopted when I was about 2 weeks old, and that got me to thinking about something I still think about every now and again, which is, where the heck was I for 2 weeks? Where was I? I wasn't with my birth mom. I wasn't with my parents. And somehow that two-week gap is a really strange thing to me.
Jonathan is next. He was adopted in the 1960s.
You talk about, like, sort of, is there this sort of this anger connected? I had two repeating dreams until I was a young adult. By young adult, I mean my 20s. And one of them was, in my dream, I would become like a wolf, like a werewolf kind of thing. I used to love those horror movies. And in my dream, I would be trying to get out of my house because I was worried I was going to kill everyone in it as a wolf, that I would rip them apart, my parents and everything. Okay. Now, there's an angry dream. So I think, you know, when you talk about kind of having underlying feelings of anger and what does it mean to be chosen or not chosen and all that kind of the attendant guilt with wanting to kill someone, what do you do with all that? And I guess you have nightmares. I guess you get depressed. I guess you drink too much for years on end. I guess you go into therapy if you're goddamn lucky. I guess if you're even lucky, you meet someone who you can form a relationship with that begins to change things for you. I mean, I guess all those things happen if you're lucky, you know, or maybe other things happen. Those things happen for me. I think maybe what cured all, I don't know, cured is a bad word. Maybe what changed all this for me is when I had my first daughter. It changed everything. It was the first time in my life I had ever seen anyone that I was biologically connected to, that I could actually look at and say, I can see myself in this child. It was like having everything, it was like all the, you know, like the plates in the earth all of a sudden like fell into a whole new pattern or something. Everything shifted under my feet because I don't know if it's like it's some basic, deep, biological level that doesn't really ever swim around in your thoughts or your mind, but it was this moment of like, I don't know, species recognition. It was not something that words did much with, where I went, oh my God, I'm actually like a part of this. I think I was always curious about my birth parents, and my brother, I think he viewed my curiosity as sort of an act of betrayal, that it betrayed the goodness of the family in a way. I mentioned to my parents many, many years ago that I found my birth mother, and you know, they were both really teary about it. It was just clear to me that it was too much for them, and that they need to have me the way they need to have me, and that's just fine. And I've never spoken about it with them again. My parents don't know that I've seen my birth mother. Well, I mean, I'm in contact with her pretty regularly. We email back and forth. And yet it is, I have three daughters. I have a wife. Her parents are getting older. My parents are getting older. My life is full with the people that I grew up with. And I can't shut a door that's been open, because that's not okay. I don't feel it's okay. I know more now, and that's moving, and I can feel that for her, and I can feel that for me, because that's partly my story now, but I would have been okay without it. I think she's a good woman. I think that this matters to her, this relationship, in a way that's deeper than it does for me. I think she feels the lack of me more than I feel the lack of her. I don't know what that's about, other than maybe, and this may not be true for everyone, maybe giving someone up is more powerful than being given up.
I do remember having a fantasy about my birth mother, and the fantasy was that she was like a gypsy, and she was, of course, in a circus, and she had, she just kind of misplaced me, and she lost me, and she couldn't find me, but she always was looking for me, and I just felt that I was this diamond in the rough, and someday she would find me and we would be reunited.
You heard from Elaine at the beginning of the hour, talking about being a birth mother. She's also part of the adoption circle as an adoptee.
For some reason, I ended up with my parents, my adopted parents. And it wasn't that great of a match with my adoptive parents. I love them dearly. I lost both of them in the last 2 years. But my mother, I was much closer to my father than I was to my mother. And it's just the way that it was. I remember my mother telling me, you know, all my adoptive mother telling me all the while, you didn't grow in my stomach, but you grew in my heart. It was kind of sad, because I do remember at one point my mother telling me that I never bonded with her. And that was why we didn't have a good relationship, which made me feel really guilty, but I bonded to her the best I could. I was born in 1957. And I was adopted at 6 months. And I think it was really common back then to wait until the baby was 6 months so that they could prove that they were adoptable, that they didn't have any serious illnesses, and they were of, you know, stable mind for a baby for 6 months old. They developed fine. So they were good merchandise, you know, for the adoptive parent. I remember spending the night with a girlfriend and she saying something about, well, nah, 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 you're adopted. And apparently my mother had told her mother that I was adopted. I knew nothing about it. Well, because it didn't mean anything to me. The word adoption didn't mean anything. So that's when I came home the next day and said, you know, what is this adoption? So that's when my mom got out the book that was common back in those days. And gosh, I wish I could remember the exact name, but The Chosen Child, that was the name of it. And it was a book showing that you were picked, you were handpicked, and you were special. And it didn't go into a lot of detail about your birth mother, but it just said that you were chosen, the chosen baby. When I did search for my biological mother, I found of her. She passed away when I was 7. So I never, you know, I never would have known her, but come to find out, she had 7 children. And I was the only one that was completely adopted out. I have met all my half siblings. And it's wonderful. I found of my sister, and she's the head of the family. She's the oldest daughter. She was skeptical, you know, she wasn't skeptical in a mean kind of way, but you know, my gosh, you know, you're 40 and you get this phone call about a sister or brother that you didn't know anything about. So I remember driving up and it was just wonderful. She had as much of the family as she could gather there. And they just greeted me. They gave me flowers. And all I wanted was my sister. I wanted to grab my sister, so I eventually got to after, you know, some time, and I just took her in the bathroom because, I mean, everyone else was around, and we just started examining, like, our bodies, and look, you have this weird thing on your hands, and you know, just looking at each other, and there was just quite a connection there. Even the air that I was breathing there, it felt like home.
You are hearing voices, and we are inside the Adoption Circle, hosted by Transom.org producer Samantha Brown.
Next up, stories from adoptive families. Here's Catherine, who adopted 2 biological siblings in the 1980s.
Originally, I wanted 11 kids, and then I decided I would have 2 biological, and then I'd adopt the rest. So I was wanting to adopt. And then I was 36 getting married, so I figured I better cut it down to 7 kids. And then I had endometriosis, couldn't have kids. So I said, okay, I tried in vitro for a few times and then decided I wanted to adopt. And they were fine with being adopted. Our first child knew right away because we were adopting the second one. They're 18 months apart, and their birth siblings. We were scrambling to get the money for the adoption, for the second adoption. When she was 2-year-old, she said, Mommy, can anybody else buy me? We stopped talking about money and said she was with us forever. My husband passed away, so suddenly I was a single parent with 2 kids, and my daughter was having a lot of issues. And so when she met her birth mother, it was great to have a second parent suddenly. And after she met her birth family, she ended up living with her birth mother for a year, which was phenomenal. She was stricter than I was and didn't take any bunk, and she straightened up. And I think she wasn't trying to play games anymore. Yeah, she was definitely maturing. She was taking responsibility for herself. And her birth mother was saying, you know, you take responsibility for yourself, and you can't be blaming everybody else for everything. And so now to have an additional parent come forward and add to their life is great. It really helps. No longer a single parent.
The Lantry family is next. They decided on international adoption. They adopted 4 children at various ages from all over China.
You know, once you go to a place like China and you see little kids sort of hanging on you and wanting somebody to care about them, it is really hard to be here. And, you know, I kept thinking, what am I going to do? Get another dress? Get another piece of jewelry, you know, with my money? Or, you know, I have a bedroom up there. A little kid could sleep in that bedroom. It's very hard to say no. Very hard to say no. And I don't know. I just knew it was the right thing to do. China was just the perfect place. We were older. They revere older people. In the United States, there was nobody who would even look at us because we were in our late 30s. If you weren't at least 35, you couldn't adopt from China. Sophia was 13 months. I wish I had kept her name. It was Sa Chi, and it meant hidden treasure. How perfect is that?
Well, people, like, when they see me with my mom, they say that I don't look a lot like her. And so I just say, oh, yeah, well, I'm adopted. And they're just like, wow, like, cool.
Ai Chun, I met her, and we were going to name her Isabel. And she said, I am Ai Chun. She was almost 11. So I said, okay. You know, well, I found out what it meant. Love exists.
I was 10 and a half years old. On the day I was going to go meet the parents, I didn't know where I was going, whatever. They just giving me photo and clothes. And then I was in a car and I was sick because I never been in a car before. And then I went to the hotel. And then, boom, this, like, American family. Like, I never saw, like, white hair, blonde hair like that. And I was scared, so I was behind the orphanage staff. And I was like, who is that? I don't want to go, that kind of stuff.
Luke, it's actually a great story. They call me up. We have a little boy. He's got a few issues, but we're looking for a family for him. And he said he has tuberculosis. He has pigeon chest, he has rickets, he has a cleft lip, he has a cleft palate, and they're severe. So I said, we'll take him. And he's been such a blessing. He's been such a blessing. Unfortunately, you know, in the orphanages, sometimes they name kids according to how they look. And he was named not such a nice name. Shen Chi was his name, and it really meant like a thing with no value.
You don't have anybody with you for love. You may have friends, but they don't love you. They just like you because you're a friend. And eventually, you're going to get adopted or they're going to get adopted. And she's gone. So you always got to make new friends or something. Or just wait. People never get adopted. People are still there. I think at some age, you're out of the orphanage and you have to work. Yeah, it stinks.
They brought him to our hotel room. They literally opened the door, handed him to us, and, like, walked out. And he screamed and fought and kicked and spit. And he was tiny, but, man, he could pack a punch. He tried to get out the door. He could reach the lock. So I had to stand between him and the door so he wouldn't unlock it. He'd never seen a mirror, and he tried to escape. He tried to get out the mirror. I ended up just bear-hugging him with my arms and legs so he couldn't fight. And he just struggled and struggled and struggled, and he fell asleep. You know, I'd asked them if he liked anything, and they said noodles. So I called downstairs and got every noodle dish on the menu. And he woke up and just started screaming again. And I, you know, handed him chopsticks and pointed at the food. And he immediately shut up. And he just ate and ate and ate. From that point forward, he was like a Velcro kid. I couldn't even go to the bathroom. He was right beside me. You know, I just remember thinking, if you're just kind to him, show him there's nothing to be afraid of. He'd never seen a toilet. He'd never seen a bathtub. Every single thing we did was a terrifying experience for him. And that first night, I read a book, you know, over and over, One Yellow Lion, over again. And the last thing in the book is One Yellow Lion. And he said it to me that night, One Yellow Lion. It just seems so simple. All you have to do is be nice. And look what you get. It was like watching a flower open up. That's what it was like.
I don't really like to talk about it in school with other people, but it's just, I feel a little great about it because out of all those people in the orphanage, they picked me. So I'm just lucky.
And then Jack's name, Jun, meant army. Yeah. And Jack, at 14, nobody else would take the chance. And now I know. It's been a rough ride. His situation was just very convoluted. Abandoned at 9. Doesn't even know if it was his real father that he was with. Just not good.
Then one day, I don't know why, what's the reason, my father took me to take a train and gave me $2.50. Says, next stop, my uncle will pick me up. And which never, no one showed up. So I was trying to ask and pretty much crying. And
so he tried to get back on the train. He thought if I could get back on the train, eventually it'll go back to where I was. And he told me he was eventually taken to a place called Children's Jail. It wasn't an orphanage. It was just a very bad place. Like the dregs of the street were sort of grounded up and taken in there. And one day they were taking out dirty mattresses and somebody left the door unlocked.
So we take the trash out and we run, never turn back, just run to next stop. And the kids told me that if policeman ask you where you want to go, orphanage. So I say orphanage. So they take me to an orphanage and where I stay.
The first thing Jack remembers about his orphanage, he walked in and there was a guy with no fingers, just stubs like hands. And they made him take off all his clothes. And he undid his belt and he hit him with the belt just so he would know who was in charge. And he was 9. That was his welcome to the orphanage. Sometimes I think about language. You know, they say there's this window of opportunity, and after a certain age, 9, 10 years old, the window closes.
Sometimes I feel like I want to speak, argue with my parents. I feel like I want to argue with the Chinese. I feel like I would win. But if I argue with the English, my vocabulary is not, oh my God, I finally said this, my vocabulary would be low, and my mom always used big word, I don't understand. It's like, great, you won. So you won.
At first he would only say, I will never go back to China. Then he found out that they can't make him stay because he's a citizen of the United States. So now he says, okay, I'll go back. And I think he would like to go find them. You know, I think he would like to go and just see what it was and to see, you know, maybe ask, like, why did you abandon me? He had 2 sisters and he remembers them. He had a grandmother that he said was nice to him. I think he probably would like to go back someday. I'd do it. I'd go with him. I mean, I just, there's not a day that goes by that I don't thank the gods or whomever it is. I pinch myself. I'm telling you, I still think people should clap when they see my kids.
Mary Ellen was adopted in the 1960s. As an adult, she decided to adopt a child through the foster care system. 5 years later, she also had a biological son.
I always knew that I would adopt. I always thought I'd have a biological child because it was something that I wanted to experience in my life. And I also always thought that I would adopt a child because having been adopted myself, it just seemed like a way that I also wanted to make my family. The story around Alicia, who's my adopted child, is that she had come to live with us as a foster child first. And it just was like God hit me over the head with a 2x4 and said, this is your kid. She had a rough early start. She was cocaine and alcohol exposed. She was born VD positive. She has some pretty significant learning challenges, and I didn't get to have her until she was 2. Alicia's now 15, and she knew the story, of course, and she'd say, did you nurse me? And I'd hold her, like, I'd rock her, and I'd say, oh, I just, you know, I so wish I'd been able to nurse you, and I so wish I'd been able to hold you when you were an infant, and do you think my birth mother did? I bet she might have, honey. Maybe she did, you know. What do you think? And it was one of the first questions I asked my birth mother when I met her. Did she hold me? Because I knew the answer to this question intuitively. She said, no, they whisk you away. I never got to see you. I never laid eyes on you. It felt like one of those areas of my life that felt like a void, that just felt like this didn't happen, or things would have been different if that happened. And again, it was a bit made up, but it was intuitively, I just knew that on some sort of pre-verbal, visceral level, like I just knew that she hadn't held me. I know adoptees, we often want to have biological children, and we'll talk about that a lot if a group of adoptees gets together, because it's often the first relative or person in the world that you know that's biologically connected to you. And that was another story around having my biological child. I'm like, once that baby comes out of my body, no one takes him out of the room. He's with me. That's fine. We're all set. And I knew what it was about. I mean, it was about my own birth, and it was about my being taken away and not being held and not being – but it didn't change the fact that, like, he was not to go anywhere, and everyone knew that. I talk about it with other friends and colleagues and people who I know who have kids who are adopted. There is a way in which – Alicia is a very different – I can't see myself in her. I can see parts of myself in her, but there's more of a familiarity to him than there is to her. Like, I know him in a different way than I know her. And so there was a while there where I thought to myself, like, oh, do I love him more than her? And is it because she's adopted, and do I treat her differently? There are times she would really feel like, you treat me differently. She'd never make the link to the adoption, but I would make the link to the adoption. So I've had to come to know her.
And finally, the Garcia Dunns.
The way I fell in love with Owen, it was pretty instantaneous. Yeah. For me and for my husband, it's, you know, I forget that he isn't from us. I really do. I mean, he just feels like he is us. He's from us, and there's no difference.
Owen seemed destined for our family.
It was just magical. Yeah, it was an instant connection with the birth parents, with this baby, and it was just beautiful.
I didn't want my son to be always wondering, you know, where did I come from, and, you know, where's my real family, and you know, why, and all that stuff. So I think that the thought of an open adoption kind of solved those problems for me. He's going to know all along who his birth mom is, and that she cares about him and loves him, and so he's never have to kind of worry about going searching for his mom or his dad or any of that. He'll know.
He was born in a birthing center, a water birth, and she nursed him until we took him. And that was, she wanted that. She said, I need to nurse him at least 8 weeks. And she made it to 7. And then she felt like, okay, she emotionally, she just needed to make that transition. You know, we believe that he picked us, and we believe that, you know, she really made it okay for him. You know, she knew all along she wasn't going to parent him. And what she expressed to me was that she's been talking to him even when he was in utero, that, you know, he was going to be with another family, and he got to choose that family, and that she loved him, and she let him know. And I just think on some level, he kind of got it, because he really has seemed okay with it. She put a lot of thought and care into this decision.
It was what was best for Owen, and that's how they looked at it. And they didn't look at, you know, in my opinion anyway, they didn't look at who had the most money. They looked at where was he going to fit in and be loved, and that's what they looked for. And I thought it was an act of love. I mean, you just look at that little personality and he's a special, you know, there's a higher power at work here, I think, you know. Inside the Adoption Circle was produced by Vicky Merrick and Samantha Brown, with editorial support from me, Jay Allison. This hour was brought to you by the public radio website, transom.org, where you can get the tools to tell your own story. You can read manifestos by great radio producers and find out what microphone to buy. Drop by anytime, transom.org. Thanks to all those who shared their stories for this hour, and special thanks to Miriam Rand and Kira Jones, Sydney Lewis, and Rob Rosenthal. This hour was produced with support from the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Ford Foundation at fordfoundation.org. Thanks to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station. From Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Jay Allison for hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.